Okay. You know, you have some who will say it's a longer cubit, some will say it's a shorter cubit. He must have been a tall man with an 18-inch dagger.
If you're right-handed,
yeah,
you would carry daggers or short swords on your left side.
Right.
Because you draw it out naturally like that. So the guards, remember, he's got guards, this kid.
Yeah.
Are going to look at, and they're going to look at the left side of a man to see if he's carrying any weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Not usually the right side, because they don't, not too many people were left-handed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so verse 17. So he brought the tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. Okay? So that's your Christmas thing for tonight. You got an early Santa, all right? The present, the tribute. Now here's the issue. Remember that he's a king of Moab. He rules in Moab, but he has at least overthrown this portion of what we would call Israel at this time, okay, in the Jericho area, and he rules over them. And he requires them to pay tribute, to pay taxes, to do whatever, because he is ruling over them. Now, clearly, Ehud had done this several times. Not only had he done it several times, clearly, as we're going to see in a little bit, he had gained trust with this king. Okay? Now you have this issue of, and some people say, well, if he gained trust and stuff, was this the right thing to do, this assassination, this type of thing? Well, we're going to see what his view of that was here in just a moment, okay, as we read about what he did. He brought these presents or these tributes to the king. They would be carried by the servants. Much of them, it's not just a matter of money here. It's a matter of different kinds of things that were grown in the land, things that they had, precious things from the land. That's what they would bring to him and stuff. So he would have other servants with him. You know, he would be like Ehud, in very real sense, would be like a dignitary that had, you know, maybe an ambassador, maybe someone who had the right to go into the king, and he would bring others with him to do the legwork, to do the heavy work and stuff. And that's what's spoken of right here when he talks about some of the servants that you're going to read about here and stuff too. Okay, he wants you to know that Eglon is a very fat man. Going to make a difference here in just a little bit. Also could speak of the reason for the length of the dagger. Okay?
It's
got to be
an 18-inch.
Yeah, 18-inch, okay. Okay, what I want you also get to is with this dagger, the killing of the dagger, again, goes into the vital organ and actually is tried to get into the heart. So the thrust of these daggers, and you're going to see this in a minute, usually is an upward thrust through here to go underneath the rib cage and to puncture the heart. So you would have to have a pretty good sized dagger, but it's a guy that's really big. So, oh, I thought I saw the pen waving. Okay, I thought you were going to tell us something about Eglon. So, okay, verse 18. And when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. So. Tribute is given to the king. It has been received, probably done with all the proper etiquette and stuff. You know, oh great king, here's a tribute that we bring you from the land, and all the flowery speeches that goes along with this, and you know all the puffing up of Eglon that could be done. You know that you did, and all the I would say false humility that he could stir up in himself to make this king think like that. You know there was. He had nothing to worry about. They were in complete submission to him. They loved him even though he ruled over them and he was a foreigner and all this kind of stuff that they would have put there before that. But he sends he sent the people away. And there's an interesting phrase here in verse 19 that I want to tie here. But he said, but he himself turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal and said, okay, the picture almost gets, and some translations are talking about this, where they begin to leave, even Ehud begins to leave, but then he turns back and sends the other on their way. Okay? And again, some commentators say he sends the others on the way because, of course, he knew what he was about to do, but nobody else knew what he was about to do. This was a dangerous thing, to go in the very court of another king to do something like this, to attempt to assassinate the king. Some believe that Ehud cared enough about these other men that were part of his group and stuff that he didn't want them to, if he got caught, he didn't want them to be associated at all. Others would say he wanted to do this without anybody, you know, anybody witnessing it. Others said that he may not even known the loyalties of all these men, as far as their loyalties to the king. Would someone stop him out of loyalty? Would someone stop him out of fear? Who knows? But he sends these men on, and he himself turns back to the king and said, "I have a secret message for you, O king." Okay, so clearly, at least from what I read here, that he has gained the confidence of this king that he would meet with him alone. He had that kind of stature. He had that kind of standing. Not everybody would. Okay, it's quite a thing for a king to tell everybody else to leave, and he would stay in a place with just one man. Okay, so after he says, "I have a message for you, king," he said, and where it says he said, that's the king. The king says, "Keep silence," and all who attended him went out from him. So the king, "keep silence," basically meant, okay, I'll meet with you alone. And he told the rest of the servants and whoever else was there, "Leave us." You've seen that in movies many times. "Leave us," you know, because he was going to talk to him. So again, unless he had confidence in Ehud, he would not have done something like this. I would almost say that if he didn't have confidence in Ehud, Ehud wouldn't have been bringing him anything. He'd have been a mortal enemy. But he had built his confidence over time. This was not the first time he had gone to the king. Not the first time he brought tribute. Probably not the first time he talked to him in, you know, in private. Questions or comments here in verse 19. Okay, verse 20. It says, "And Ehud came to him." Now he was sitting upstairs in a cool private chamber. Then Ehud said, "I have a message from God for you." So he rose from his seat. Okay, a couple things here. Sometimes the terminology is kind of interesting, but those of you who've been over to the Middle East, do you remember that almost every house had an upstairs porch? Almost every house. They're built flat. They're built for places to sit. Eventually, they're built for building another room on top, you know, in the more modern thing. But until that happens, they use them to sit, you know, where the cool breezes and stuff like that. You have a porch here, is what you have, above the ground floor. How far above? We have no idea. We don't know how big the palace was or the place where they were at was. But a place where he could go and sit, where the cool breeze was and stuff like that. It was clearly, because of some of the other things that are said in a minute, a very private place for the king. It wasn't like the room where you would say the throne was or something where a lot of people come in. It was a very private place, a place that the king went by himself. It wasn't unusual for him to be by himself, nor was it apparently unusual for him to take someone privately in there with him to talk. Okay, nothing seemed out of the ordinary to anyone, including the king. So he has him up there in that private room, that cool chamber, if you will, is what it says in my translation. It says, "Then Ehud said, 'I have a message from God for you.'" Now, let me just say this. Up until this point, the word God that has been used in the book of Judges has been the word Yahweh, Lord. In your King James, your New King James, it's translated Lord every time. Now we have another word that's used here. We have the word El that's used here. This is no longer Yahweh. This is the word El. Okay. Remember this. Okay. Yahweh represents the name of God that was given to Moses. I am that I am. Okay. Which we translate Yahweh. Okay. El means God. And you notice I did a small g there because it means God, whether you're talking about the one true God or you're talking about a false God. It's the same way we would say to somebody today that, you know, if you have pagans today and you say they worship, they would say, we worship our God. And we find out that their God maybe, let's say their God is some tree out in the forest somewhere. Well, to them, the same word is used, God. Okay? But we know that's not God. It's a tree out in the forest somewhere. There's only one true God. Okay? He chooses to use the word God that would speak to this king from a position that this king would understand. He goes back to, if I can put it this way, it sounds awful, but it goes back to the generic name God, or generic word God, rather than the specific name that is given to the Hebrew God. Okay? And what he says here is, I have a message from God for you. Now, you have to wonder what this king might have been thinking. Does this guy have some sort of word of dread or woe to me, for me? Does he have some sort of prophecy? But notice what the king does. The king gets up and stands up and starts to come over to him and stuff. So, interesting scenario that takes place here.
So the king thinks he's going to get a message from one of his gods?
I don't know.
From El?
From El.
Right. In this scenario that you're painting, yes, I would say
yeah.
So. But I'm more interested in Eden. Who's he representing?
Well, I think we know who he's representing. It's proper to use El for God. Because in Genesis, remember, El or Elohim is what's used for God. Okay? So what we say Jehovah or Yahweh is usually translated in the King James or the New King James is Lord. Capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. That word is Yahweh in there. Okay? Now we come to this matter from Ehud's perspective. What is he doing? He clearly believes that he's been sent by God for a great mission. Okay? Now, I don't want to get any fights or get anything thrown at me or anything like that. So, let me see if I got good arms. I want to stay away from the people who have the best arm. What would set Ehud apart from the Muslim terrorists that are doing what they do today? Someone want to explain that to me?
Verse 15 says, the Lord raised up a deliverer for them.
Okay. Well, I agree with you. But from the perspective of the one who believes they're raised up, what would be the difference?
One man. What's the same question with Abraham, too? You have somebody that was going to sacrifice their kid.
Yeah, we would really have a problem with someone who's going to sacrifice their kid and say, God said, do it today, wouldn't we?
So it's all a matter of what God says about it.
That's a fine line because
I think it is.
You're talking about a radical. And are we not supposed to be radicals?
Well, that's the whole first quarter of next year's message is radical Christianity, yeah.
So the answer is there's no real difference. The Muslims who are doing that are believing they are doing it, okay, for Allah. Whether Allah is a God or not, it doesn't make any difference. They think they're doing it for the right reason. Well, Ehud thinks he's doing it for the right reason.
So the only difference would be the source.
Correct.
The source. Maxine.
I have a question the last part of verse 15, which says, the Israelites sent him. That means, if you don't mind, I'm going to call him Ehud.
I don't care what you call him.
Anyway, they use a lot of hard vowels, you know, and so
yeah.
They aren't soft. So anyway, with a tribute, Israel sent him with a tribute.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the tribute? I'd like a little.
That's what I say. It's a taxation. It is a recognition that he is. And what it says that he is lording over them, so they're paying him a tribute, like you would say, he has authority over. So we're gonna send him taxes. We're gonna send him a recognition of his kingship over us. That's the situation that they're finding themselves in, and they're actually doing it so that he will not attack them.
Right, it's a payoff.
payoff. It's a payoff, so they won't. So he won't attack.
Doing for 18 years.
Like a mercenary.
Correct.
Yeah, but yeah, in a sense of saying, okay, we will keep sending you money and goods and all these things, and recognize your authority over us if you will not attack us and destroy us. So that's what that tribute is. But yeah, I think you have a clearer or more concise pronunciation of his name. That's what I had trouble in Hebrew class with too. But I have trouble in English class, so that's okay with pronunciation. So, okay. Hi, Otta.
Hi.
Where are we at? We're at verse 21. Okay. Says, then Ehud, or whatever, reached. So I can mess up a two syllable one. It doesn't matter. Reached with his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh, and he thrust it into his belly. Okay. Belly, midsection. Reality is anywhere in here. Okay. Anywhere in here. Remember what he was doing. Remember where he was. Where he was. He was going for the kill. He was going for the quick kill. The reason for the dagger again. A skilled assassin with a dagger can kill quickly and can kill in such a way that the one that they're killing has no ability to sound warning or to make any noise. So, what's he do? He takes his dagger and he thrusts it into his belly. As it says here, and it says even the hilt went in after the blade. So, I know some of you haven't eaten yet, but I mean, this is why Teresa, when she taught third grade boys, they thought this is the greatest thing in the world. He sliced him open like a ripe watermelon is what he did. And notice what it says there. It went into the hilt of the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. So,
is that what just says, entrails?
Yeah, some of them say. Tell me what some of them says. Says what?
Feet around a bush. Refuse.
Refuse. Yeah. Another translation says something like this. Says it actually puts it this way, and it came out behind.
Yeah, that's mindset.
Is that the King James?
It doesn't say anything about it.
And he says out his back.
Yeah. Okay. But some of them say that the part is he was sliced completely open.
Yeah.
However you want to describe it. It's pretty graphic.
Yeah.
Okay. This man has no hope. He kills the king. By the way, you can compare what it says here about what took place if you want to. 2 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 10 talks some about this same type of thing about a killing in this way where the entrails, the intestines, and everything comes out in a not very dignified way. Okay? It's a cruel way to die. But clearly a quick way for him to die also. Okay? All right, verse 23. Then Ehud went out through the porch and shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. So how did he leave? The normal way. Okay? Locks the doors behind him and leaves the king in there. Okay? All right. Now, verse 24. When he had gone out, Eglon's servants came to look, and to their surprise, the doors of the upper room were locked. So they said, he is probably attending to his needs in the cool chamber. Some of your translation may say, he's covering his feet. And others may say, relieving himself. I don't think they had a port-a-john at that time, so it probably doesn't say anything about a J-John or anything like that. But their assumption is, he's in there using the bathroom. And they do not want to embarrass him or be embarrassed. They talked about being uncovered in a way that would not be acceptable for a king to be uncovered in front of his servants. Okay. And the reality is, in this scenario, it has nothing to do with nudity. They wouldn't. I don't even know that they'd have a whole lot of problem with nudity. It's being uncovered doing something that is unclean like that, is a reference that is used here. Okay, input, always input.
Not on that one.
Not on that.
Oh, come on. Look, right away they make the assumption he's relieving himself. Why? Because he has spilled everything out on the floor and they can smell it. That's
yeah,
why.
Yeah.
I know you didn't want to say that, but that's what it is.
I don't think it could necessarily be that. It just means that they waited so long, they thought, you know, it doesn't take this long to take care of nature's call, so.
Well, he's a big guy. Okay.
Wait, Maxine, it doesn't say that. It says, when he had gone out, his servants came and looked, and behold, the doors of the roof chamber were locked, and they said, he is only relieving himself.
No, well, I'm talking about they waited to the point of embarrassment. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, that follows that, right. But they first made the statement he's relieving himself, and I would have to believe that's because they...
But then we go to verse 25 and we go on with them. It says, so they waited to the, everyone says, they waited till they were embarrassed and still he had not opened the door of the upper chamber.
Why would they be embarrassed?
Well, I'm just here are a lot of assumptions, but no one likes to stand outside the bathroom door of somebody else. And I'm going to go a little bit with what Doug said. Whether initially they had that thought, after standing outside that door for a while and this guy has been cut up all over the floor, I'm sure the odor is probably moving through the chambers. Okay? Wouldn't you suppose? I mean, to a place of embarrassment and stuff? You know?
Depends on what interpretation. Yours says embarrassed.
Yeah, what's yours
saying? It says anxious. They became anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Mine says embarrassed.
Okay. What did you say?
Mine says embarrassed too. But I'm wondering if it couldn't be that they were supposed to be there to take care of him and maybe clean up or whatever. And so,
Teresa, you had to go there, didn't you?
Well, maybe they're anxious because.
But she may be right. You're talking about a very large king, and it may have been a practice that when he was finished, that he would call and say, "Come in and clean me." You see all the possibilities that make this a fascinating thing? Isn't it interesting what we hang upon? My wife is going to say when we're heading home, I can't believe you said that. Your mind is messed up. More fiber. Not anymore. Yeah.
The only thing I can tell about you people is you haven't spent very much time in a nursing home.
There you go. There you go.
Yep. Right. Yeah, actually, your view changes when you deal with someone who cannot take care of himself. Your view changes on these things. You're right.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to leave that right where it's at.
Okay.
And we're going to move on. Because they do, in the middle of verse 25, finally, they took the key, they opened the door, and there was their master fallen dead on the floor. I don't know if they even intend, I certainly didn't intend for that to rhyme, but that's exactly what they did. Okay. Verse 26. But Ehud escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the stone images and escaped to Serah. Okay, so he's gotten away. Okay, now something, there's information not given to us at the beginning of this scenario that's given to us now. This was not just a plot just for Ehud to assassinate the king of Moab. He had another plan. Not only did he have another plan, he had people waiting for his part to be accomplished. And we're going to read that. We're going to see what took place. Verse 27. And it happened when he arrived that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them. So he blows the shofar, the trumpet. He blows that, and clearly these people were waiting. So The Lord sent him. Israel sent him. Was there a contingency of leaders who knew what he was doing and why he was going and what was going to happen? I think it's clear that there was. And they were waiting with their men for him to come back, and the signal, clear, a signal would be that he would blow, if everything went as he planned, then he would blow the trumpet and the men would follow him. Now, a king has died. When the king died, who's in charge? Well, a lot of them can say it depends on who's in charge of that kingdom and stuff. But you, most likely you're going to have a people that are going to be in disarray. They're going to be in confusion. They're not going to know what to do and stuff. Their king is gone. Okay, and so the Israelites are going to take advantage of that. They're going to take advantage of this assassination. They're going to take advantage of the chaos that is caused by it. And they're going to attack. And they're going to follow Ehud to this place. Okay, so from Ephraim, which are mountains, and by the way, the Jordan River Valley runs from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. And it is a valley. It is not a deep valley like we consider like the Valley of the Sun. It's a rift. Okay, and out of the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River flows, and it flows down into the Dead Sea. But just beyond the Jericho sets right by the Jordan River, and right on the edge of the Jordan and on the edge of the mountains. So once you leave Jericho, you head right into the mountains and go actually up into Jerusalem. There, the Judean wilderness that's spoken of in the New Testament and Judean hills that are spoken of in the New Testament, this is the area we're talking about, right down here, between Jericho and Jerusalem. Okay, and you have hills all around this area. Okay, Ephraim was that area that was considered north of Jericho. Ephraim was actually another name. It was a name of one of the tribes, of course, but it was also another name for the northern tribe of Israel. Ephraim. Okay? And it would start right at that point. So he brings these Israelite warriors with him. And now we read on. It says, verse 28. Then he said to them, "Follow me, for the Lord hath delivered your enemies, the Moabite, into your hand." So before the war ever takes place, he's confident. Everything that God had told him to do has happened. And he's fulfilled God's plan for him. And again, he had followed God's direction. And this is not a... Sometimes it's hard for we who are I want to say peace-loving people. It's kind of hard for us to see the graphic nature of what God had called him to do. But elsewhere in the Old Testament, we'll have God tell... Remember what he told him? He told David at times, you go in, you destroy everything. And we read that and we say, that doesn't make sense to me. But God says you go and you destroy everything. Okay? So, he is confident that God is going to give the Moabites into his hand. God has raised him up for this purpose. God has assured him that he's going to do this. And so it says, so they went down after him, seized the fords of the Jordan leading to Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross over. So they pretty much took command of the land. Okay. They did not go so much into the area of Moab. They weren't trying to defeat the Moabites in the sense of they weren't trying to take over the land of the Moabites. What they were actually trying to do is cast them out of their land and take control of their land, where the Moabites would no longer have influence or power over the Israelites. That's what they were doing. And that's the picture that he gives there when he talks about that they seized the fords of the Jordan and they did not let them come across. They took control of their own borders. Okay? It wasn't they were trying to acquire more land. They just were going to take back what was theirs. Okay. Questions or comments on that before we move on? Verse 29. And at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab. All stout men of valor. Not a man escaped. Okay? So, they killed 10,000 men. It's quite a battle. Some of your translation would say, let's see, what are some of the words they use there? 10 Eleph men. Talking about different numbers. 10 Eliph men, and instead of men of valor or stout men, they some of them said lusty men and men of valor.
Vigorous and strong.
Right. So these were their warriors that is described here. And notice what God does. God gives them victory. What's interesting to me is they killed 10,000 of the Moabites. It's not recorded how many Israelites died. Okay. You suppose, what do you suppose? How many do you suppose died? Do you suppose any died?
Yeah.
I would say yeah. But clearly they defeated the Moabites. And the best that the Moabites had, they killed, they defeated. Okay? So, verse 30 tells us, so Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land rested now. How long? 80 years. Okay? So if you think about it, the first two judges that we've been looking at, again, some people will say, some people look at this as linear. Other people look at this as, remember we talked about regional? What was the area that we assume was the first battle that took place? Because of who was involved. Would have been up here, and we had the Judah that came up. Some say Judah came up and helped them. Okay? But this was the area that's referred to with the first judge. Okay? Othniel. Okay? Up here. This is the area down here that's referred to with Ehud. Did they happen at the same time? Did they, you know, are we talking linear and stuff? Again, you have different opinions. Different opinion. What seems to be clear, though, is not every judge, and maybe just a few, actually even dealt with the entirety of the land of Israel. They dealt with different regions of the land of Israel. Okay, different aspects of different regions of the land of Israel. I think that we always think that each judge that was raised, it's in our mind that each judge that was raised up influenced all the land of Israel. But I don't know if that's true. As you read it, I don't see that that's necessarily true. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Do you have a time frame for the book of Judges?
What was it we're looking at? Trying to see. Hang on. I had something written down. About 1100 BC in that region. Most people believe. How many years did it span?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. It depends on how you look at it. Because some people do linear and they add all these things together and they say the time of Judges was this long. While others say no, some of them overlap each other because they deal with other things. So you have different opinions on that.
Say at least over 300 years.
Yeah. Even with all the lapping, yes. It's kind of hard. I don't know how much they overlap, but I'm not one who believes we're talking about linear when we're talking about the 40 years ended, this happened for 18 years, and then you add another 80 years to that. Okay. Somehow there is some overlapping that's taking place here.
Of course, you're looking at as how most people look at it. Every time we read this, you're thinking of the whole nation, and it's not the whole nation. It's certain areas at certain times.
Right.
Sometimes both, two different areas at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So we're going to finish chapter 3 because the next judge is what's referred to by some scholars as a minor judge. Now, I don't know if I really like that matter of minor judge, except for it's kind of like a minor prophet. It does not mean they're less important. It just means that there's not a whole lot written about. Okay? And if you look at the difference between the major prophets and the minor prophets in the Old Testament, the major prophets usually prophesied over a long period of time over many events. Minor prophets are usually raised up by God for one event for a short period of time. Okay? Both of them important, we would agree, right? Just had a different purpose. Okay? So now, there's only one verse given to this judge in this chapter. In verse 31, it says, after him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goat. And he also delivered Israel. Now, verse you jump over to chapter 5 and verse 6, in the Song of Deborah, Shamgar is mentioned. Okay? Mentioned what he did. And it talks about during that time, the highways were deserted and the travelers walked along the byways, which simply means, or means that it was a very dangerous time. Okay, how did they travel? They didn't travel out in the open. Why? And we know under Shamgar the reason is because of the Philistines. Now, what is the land of the Philistines that we've looked at? Down here, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod. Okay, today known as, Bruce says, what would be part of what's called the Gaza Strip. Okay, all right. What's said about Shamgar? Said that it doesn't tell us how many years he served. It doesn't talk about the peace of Israel. It doesn't even talk about the fall of Israel or why God raised him up. All it just tells about him. And it says that he killed how many men?
600
men of the Philistines with an ox goad. And he also delivered Israel. Now that's quite a statement. That's quite a feat, yes. You know, you talk about Samson and you talk about the other ones and stuff, but you see here that this man was raised up, empowered by God to use an ox goad. And anybody know what an ox goad is?
It's probably a long, heavy stick type thing to stick into an ox so it'll start to run or start to move at least.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
Mine says a long stick with a small flat piece of iron on one side and a sharp point on the other.
Usually the things I read said about 2 meters in length, so that would be
6 feet.
That, you know, about 6 feet.
Wow. That's good.
Okay. Yeah. Or an early spear, I guess. But a goad, you remember when the cows are not moving and stuff, you poke them and they.
And are the people taller than or something?
No, if I was carrying, remember William Wallace in Braveheart? He was a little short guy, but he had a big old sword.
It'd be hard to carry a thing then.
But remember the ox goad was used so you could stay away from the ox also, and poke it. Yeah, and there's a reason why you want to stay away from the ox too. You know, you poke it, keep it going and stuff. Okay. Yeah. Well, there's that. You have that problem too, and you have the what we might call it the Elihu problem. Never mind. Okay. So, incredible feat of God through Shamgar, and again, that's what we're told about. We're told about the time that he was a judge. It was a very troubled time, and the trouble that they were having was from the Philistines. By the way, this is the first judge that we have recorded for us that deals with the Philistines. We don't know the time frame here, and we don't know how long. We don't even know if God raised him up to bring, because the people were in rebellion in that sense, and he brought any peace. We just know that God used him to kill 600 of these Philistines. Okay.
My little note down here on the bottom talks about this minor judge that says that he was probably, because of his name, he was foreign. So he's probably not an Israelite. And then it talks about the son of Anna.
Yeah, his father was named, actually that's a Canaanite goddess.
Right.
The name Anath is a name for a Canaanite god, Baal's sister. Mm-hmm. And some of the research that I did said this is the one who searched for Baal. And apparently, I don't know all the mystery of or mythology of Baal, but it talks about she searched for Baal because Baal had died, and his sister smites death so Baal could live. So there's mythology all the way back there also, and she's actually also called the virgin. Okay, she's referred to as the virgin.
Well, do you think that's because he's not talked about? Do you think it's because he wasn't in it?
Well, what we found out, if that's true, which it seems like it would make sense, well, two things could happen. You could have some apostate Israelites that named their child after a false goddess because they'd given into that. That could have happened. But remember, we've already found out that the first judge that we looked at was not an Israelite, which was an interesting fact that was brought up last week. He was a Kenite.
I wonder what his name means, Shamgar.
Shamgar. I don't have a meaning for him.
Destroyer. Destroyer. Well, that would be... It's like...
Is that what yours has? Destroyer?
Means, where is the splendor? And I think that's kind of sad. Where is the splendor? So that has like an ironic twist on that whole story.
Yeah.
Where is the splendor?
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, we're... Go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
In that Song of Deborah that you said?
Yeah.
It says in the days of... Is it JL or however you say that?
Uh-huh.
That's who Deborah's going to deal with.
Yes.
Too. So that's...
So we have a correlation that's going on at the same time, Deborah and Shamgar and that, yeah.
My Bible has kind of an interesting note that's a little off the subject, but it says, observe the seven illustrations of 1 Corinthians 1:27, and then it lists the seven. It's an ox goad, a tent peg, trumpets, pitchers, torches, millstone and jawbone of a donkey. And 1 Corinthians 1:27 said, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty.
Huh.
Wow.
Interesting.
That's an interesting...
I like that. All right, we're going to stop there. We'll, chapter 4 next week. And so you want to read ahead on Deborah and Barak. And not our president, the other Barak.
Oh,
not next week, I'm sorry. After the first year. Okay. Bruce, would you voice our prayer, please, Edward Smith?